From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. As some of our listeners may know, there are currently around 500,000 ethnic Koreans in the former Soviet states, mainly in Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan. Here to talk about this group is Victoria Kim, who has spent a long time working on a multimedia project about Koreans in Uzbekistan. Victoria is a multimedia writer and producer based in Beijing, and she has a personal connection, having grown up in Uzbekistan with a grandfather who is ethnically Korean. I'm very excited to have her here to share her stories, so let's get started. Victoria, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jen. I appreciate this opportunity to talk about my project in a little bit more detail.
Right. So to get right into it, can you give us a little bit of your background? How did you become interested in doing this project on Koreans in Central Asia and in Uzbekistan? And what's your personal connection there?
Yes, sure. Well, I actually have a direct and quite personal connection, I think, to this story and to this whole topic and area of research on the Uzbekistanian Central Asian Koreans. It starts, first of all, with my family background. I'm quarter Uzbekistani Korean myself. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, Kim Dagir, he was a Korean who came to Uzbekistan at the age of 7 on the train, on the famous train during the deportation of 1937. When the Soviet Koreans were deported from the Russian Far East to Central Asia, namely to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, and he and his parents and siblings were on the trains that went all the way to Uzbekistan. There were about 172,000 people deported, and almost between one quarter and one third, almost one third of them died on those trains. There were like 40,000 people, and the remaining Koreans basically split between Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, roughly half-half. So his family and my Korean ancestors, they were among the deportees who ended up in Uzbekistan. So basically, that's why my grandfather ended up in Uzbekistan, and he was brought up there and later studied and worked elsewhere in the Soviet Union, but came back eventually with his wife and daughter, with his Russian wife by ethnicity, and my mom. So we basically all ended up in Uzbekistan. I think this is one of the reasons that I became very interested in this whole topic of research eventually, and carrying this family background, family history. And also the fact that the deportation itself and the arrival of Koreans to Central Asia and to Uzbekistan in particular, it's still an area of research and I think a topic of storytelling, if we can call it like that, which is still quite under discussed. So eventually I got a degree in Korean studies in the US at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. I graduated in 2007, and then I worked on different issues, and later eventually did another degree in journalism, in multimedia journalism. And this is one story which I always wanted to come back. And eventually Soviet Koreans, or post-Soviet Koreans, Central Asian Koreans, as we can call them, I always wanted to focus on the deportation and to try and tell the stories behind the deportation. My grandfather's story was one of them. There are many more stories and human tragedies and drama, tragedies of human beings, of people, of Koreans as ethnicity, as a nation. So I always wanted to tell those stories. And this is what eventually my project Lost and Found in Uzbekistan, the Korean stories, ended up being.
Did you grow up in Uzbekistan then?
Yes, I did grow up in Uzbekistan. And I spent most of my life in Uzbekistan. I went to study abroad when I was in my early 20s, basically. And then I kept working and living abroad and eventually married. And my husband is Mexican, so we keep living abroad and changing countries over the course of our lives. But my family still lives in Uzbekistan, and it's my home country. which is very dear to my heart. And this project is also part of our Uzbekistani and Central Asian social and political history and heritage, if to say so. So it's a very important part of my personal and professional upbringing and background.
Right, absolutely. Your project is really—it's very fascinating. It's got video, it has photos, stories from various Koreans who live in Uzbekistan, including some of your own family members, as you mentioned. What was it like to hear these stories from your family members, and did you know much about their story before you started looking into this project?
Yeah, thank you very much for this question. It's a very good question. Actually, the idea of this project as such was born pretty much after 2007 when my grandfather passed away, unfortunately. And as I mentioned, he was Korean and he was very close to me. He was the one who raised me, brought me up together with my mom and my granny. And I loved my grandfather very much. And I was always aware of the fact that he was Korean, because he was the only Korean in our family, and he was very different from the rest of us. He had like different physical features, and we had Korean relatives, and he loved Korean food. So his Koreanness and this Koreanness in our family and in my home city Tashkent, in my home country Uzbekistan, was always something that I was very interested. Why? How did it happen that Koreans were living in Uzbekistan, that we had Korean food around, that we ate Korean food at home, and that my grandfather was Korean. So I asked him once when I was a small child, "Grandpa, how come you are Korean? And why do we have Korean people in Uzbekistan? Were you born here?" And that's how I heard the story about the deportation for the first time. But since I was a little child, and I don't think my grandfather really wanted to talk about this, he only told me very briefly that he and his family members were brought to Uzbekistan on the trains. And he shared with me the fact that all Koreans, they were brought to Uzbekistan on the trains. And that's the only thing he ever told me. He has never shared the story of his arrival, or how did they end up being alive, and what did it cost them, how much effort and struggle did it cost to him and his own family basically to establish themselves and survive and become very successful Soviet citizens. My grandfather had quite a successful career. He studied in Uzbekistan, my home country in Tashkent. Later, he went to study in Moscow at the university. And these were, I think, late 40s, early 50s. It was a very difficult time. And I can imagine he was highly educated for his ethnicity and his background and his age. He was a chief engineer in one of very important construction bureaus in Tashkent. So he never really told me the details, though I think it was a question I always had. And it just happened so that in the course of life, we never really had a chance to sit down and talk about it properly. And I finished my master's degree in Korean studies, and I was in Washington, D.C., when he died, and it happened that I couldn't go back and say goodbye to him back then. So losing him was something which was very deep personal drama for me. But besides losing him as my grandfather and our family member, losing his Koreanness and losing this Korean heritage in my family, it was something very dramatic. And somehow I think it struck me that this is also part of history that is just slipping away from us, because those people, the original deportees, they are mostly dead by now. And my grandfather is buried on the Korean cemetery. We have Korean, not one, I'm sure we have several Korean cemeteries in my home country and in and around those Korean collective farms where Koreans ended up working and establishing themselves, their families, and their state enterprises. So he's buried on that cemetery among many other Koreans. There are so many graves of those people. And so I always wanted to do this project while I still had a chance to talk to those people, at least to some of them, so that they could share their family stories. And the story of my grandfather is lost partially. The small details, maybe they're lost, but the emotions are there, and just maybe to tell a bigger story and show a bigger picture, and in this way somehow not let my grandfather's story and history and memories slip away.
There were a lot of really interesting moments and details while reading the stories and listening to the videos. Was there anything that stands out that surprised you when you started the project?
I knew the facts behind the deportation and the facts behind the arrival of Koreans to Central Asia in general and to Uzbekistan, my home country. But I guess those little details that people were sharing in their stories, and my story characters were sharing all the details of the work, of the hard physical labor that Koreans had to put into developing the farmlands around Tashkent. This was one very striking thing I was not fully aware about before I started working on this project and writing the stories and interviewing people. For instance, one of my story's major character, Nikolai Ten, he talks in detail in several interviews, telling the story of his parents, how they met working together on those fields. And basically, when Koreans arrived in 1937, they were considered as unreliable people. So they were like suspects because of the fact that they were labeled war criminals and Japanese spies. So they were put under constant guard by the armed military personnel. I imagine it was like that everywhere where they were put upon their arrival in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. But I know the details from the interviews about those Koreans who came and they were put to live around Tashkent in the Tashkent province. These areas in the town of Chirchik, back then they were swamps full of cane, water and malaria mosquitoes. And the Koreans were forced to work on those swamps, drying them out, cutting all the cane and turning those swamps into arable lands. If you travel to Uzbekistan nowadays, and if you come to Tashkent, we have bazaars, we have a lot of people, different ethnicities, and we have those fruitful gardens and fields surrounding Tashkent, mostly cotton and fruit orchards. Those orchards, gardens, and fields, they used to be swamps, and the people who turned them into arable, fruitful fields and gardens from those swamps in less than 5 years, actually. They say that they turned those swamps into fruitful land, which is amazing. And I can imagine it was a very hard physical sacrifice. And they eventually ended up living there and they built their first houses there. And slowly, very slowly, they were able to turn those fields into collective farms. And in the early and mid-1950s, after they were sort of pardoned by the new Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, they were able to become fully-fledged Soviet citizens and work on those collective farms as a fully-fledged Soviet citizen. So I think just that amount of personal and professional sacrifice and time that it cost them to establish themselves as what is now one of most fully-respected ethnic diaspora in my home country, I did not know all the details behind this process and what really it cost to all Korean as a diaspora.
Right, so that leads into my next question really well. So you're telling a story of people who are constantly being uprooted. And on the site you write, how many motherlands can one lose and how many of them can one get? And that really stood out to me. It kind of was one line that really explained a lot about the story you were trying to tell. So how have these experiences shaped this diaspora and how they interact with the communities that they ended up in Central Asia?
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic, I think. And I think also this experience is very diverse and there are a lot of things which stand out and which unite Koreans. And then maybe each country in Central Asia has its own fascinating and special details, of course. But I think overall, one striking thing that unites all Korean people as Central Asian Koreans or Soviet Koreans, as a diaspora, as Koreans, and as Koryosaram, because they identify themselves mostly as Koryosaram or Koryoin, Korean people, because when most of those Koreans emigrated from Korea, what was the northern part, which is present in North Korea, actually, Hamgyong province, it's, I think, one of the most northern provinces in North Korea now. Back then, it was still one country. They started moving to Russia at the end of the 19th century. So in the 1860s, the first 13 Korean families, they were found by the Russian convoy on the newly acquired territory. Those territories, they were actually new for Russia because before that, they used to belong to the Qing dynasty. That whole area, the proximity of countries like Russia and China and Japan, along that border and along that geographical areas where Koreans ended up moving to. These Korean people were trying to keep their Koreanness all the way through, which is amazing. When they moved to Russia, initially they were very different from other people in the Far East, in that remote and underpopulated areas. And when the Russian military found them, eventually the Tsar's government let them stay in Russia because they desperately needed people to develop those remote lands in the Far East. They were very different from Russians and other mostly European cultures. Their physical appearance, in their language, in their food, in their beliefs. So there was racism and they had difficult times, I imagine. But on the other hand, they were led to stay there and build their villages there, which eventually from those villages, they became under the Soviet rule, and the dramatic change in Soviet Revolution in basically turned Russian Empire to the Soviet Union. The district where most of them lived, in the Posyet district, in the Far East, right across the border from the Japan-run Manchukuo in the late 1930s, from where they were deported to Central Asia, to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. So they always lived in those tight communities before. And later, upon their arrival to Central Asia, everywhere where they arrived in Central Asia, mostly in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, they were put under the armed guard and made to live in those barracks initially in also very closed and tight Korean communities. So I think all Koreans, they kept their Koreanness as a way to survive, and I guess as a way also to keep their, I guess, like collective memory and history and belonging. So they tried to preserve as much as they could. It was not easy because under the Soviet rule, they were discriminated. Their language was discriminated. It happened to all ethnicities who lived in the Soviet Union. Like Soviet Russian traditions were dominant, the language and traditions. So it was very difficult for all ethnicities, not only for Koreans, also for Uzbeks. It really cost them a lot to try and keep their language, try and keep their culture, try and keep their customs, their cuisine. So I think one great thing which has happened with the Korean community in my home country after the independence, when my home country was trying, especially in the early 90s, trying to establish itself as an independent country, independent nation with its own language, with its own history, culture, cuisine, which had existed throughout generations. Also Koreans, they were somehow maybe given a second chance to establish themselves as a Korean diaspora in a newly independent Uzbekistan. And I think they have quite succeeded in it. And also actually South Korea supports the Korean communities in my home country. We have Korean cultural centers where people, young and old, Korean people of Uzbekistan, they gather together and they still celebrate their holidays, share their traditions and customs and food and festivities. So I think this is one very important thing that unites them as Koreans. And I think this is very similar to what all Koreans share, no matter where they are worldwide.
Right. So another really fascinating topic that I did not know about at all was the participation of Uzbek Koreans in the Korean War. And you tell the story of Alexei Ten, who joined the North Korean side and remained in the DPRK after the war. Can you tell us a little bit more about the experience of those Soviet Koreans who found themselves fighting on the North Korean side and eventually staying there?
The involvement of Central Asian Koreans in the Korean War on the North Korean side, I think this is something that is still quite under-discussed, and this is most sensitive and secretive part of the history of post-Soviet Koreans and Central Asian Koreans. So only in the 1980s, when Mikhail Gorbachev came to power, during perestroika and glasnost, and he introduced the freedom of speech, let's say, so many topics, they became open, including the deportation of the Koreans to Central Asia. And then slowly, the involvement of the Central Asian Koreans into the Korean War very slowly started being also an open history. But still, it's not something which is being widely and publicly recognized. They were around 140 Koreans for sure, maybe even more. This is something that needs to be further researched. And this is something which I would love to keep researching, because I think this is also one of the most fascinating parts of the Central Asian Korean history. Those Koreans who served in the military ranks in the 1950s, when the Korean War broke out, they mostly served in Central Asia, in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, in the military academies there. One of those academies was the Chirchik Military Academy, and at least 80 people from Uzbekistan, 80 Koreans from Uzbekistan and 60 Koreans from Kazakhstan, they joined Kim Il-sung when he officially requested, he basically sent a plea to the Soviet government and Soviet Koreans, because he knew that there were Koreans in Central Asia. And I guess he also knew that they were from the north mostly. So he requested those Koreans to come and join him to save their Korean motherland from the capitalist aggressors. And also Soviet Union, Stalin's government supported Kim Il-sung. He had very close relationship with Stalin as well as Mao. They all kind of kept very close relationships. So those Koreans, the military leadership in those academies, they became his closest allies, his military apparatus. They fought the Korean War shoulder to shoulder with him. And they actually became his first government, his first military apparatus. All of those Koreans, they had been highly trained, so they became generals, admirals, marshals, high military ranks. Many of them, because they had very successful careers there, many of them got married or remarried there with North Korean women, established their families or re-established their families in North Korea. So they actually had successful careers and life in North Korea until the split up, the very famous historical split up after Stalin's death and new leadership, Khrushchev came to power, and then there was a fallout throughout mid and late 1950s between the Soviet Union and North Korea, as well as between Soviet Union and China. The relationship got worse, and Kim Il-sung started being suspicious, thinking that the new Soviet government was planning a coup d'etat against him. So the first people who became suspects, which is also a historical irony, and this is something I write in my story, Lost and Found in Uzbekistan, the Korean story, how the historical cycle has closed and they became the suspects and traitors again. These people, those Koreans, throughout that time, they were being purged. And basically Kim Il-sung wanted to erase, not only erase them, but erase the whole existence. So many of them were killed, some of them were sent somewhere far away with their families. It's very difficult to know. Most of them had families or relatives in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. And back then, while Soviet republics and North Korea, they had a more friendly stance between each other. Those people, they were sending letters to each other, and that's how they kept in touch. So when those Koreans were purged in North Korea, their family members, relatives, and friends in the Soviet Union back then, they basically, they didn't know what had happened to their beloved ones. So the only thing that they knew, and this is something I also learned, that's another story that struck me particularly, as I learned it from Nikolai Tan while he was talking about his paternal uncle, Alexei Tan, who became a general himself in the Kim Il-sung military apparatus and government. He became a deputy minister of defense. He kept in touch, he had kept in touch with his brother before the purge. And he himself remarried with a North Korean woman, and his firstborn son, Leonid, or little Leonia, the family back in Tashkent in Uzbekistan knew that boy very well too, their nephew, because he was from Alex's first wife, who was an Uzbekistani Korean herself too. So they kept in touch with Alexei and his first son especially, who wrote them postcards and letters in Korean and even in Russian, a little bit, he remembered the Russian language. So when Alexei was purged, and he and the whole family, basically, of course, they were purged, how they learned about it back in Uzbekistan, the letters that they were sending to Alexei, they started coming back with a stamp, the recipient is unknown. I think Alexei's brother kept sending those letters for years, basically trying to reach his brother. And for years, his letters kept coming back. So we don't know exactly when he was purged, maybe in the late 1960s or early 1970s. The rest of the details I also know from Nikolai's stories, how his father, for years, he was pleading the North Korean embassy in Tashkent and later in Moscow to give him details. He was going there many times, and he ended up talking with the ambassador himself, with the North Korean ambassador in Moscow. And that person told him finally, because he saw that Alexei's brother was not going to give up, and he told him personally, he said, look, your brother was purged. We don't know what happened to him, and we'll never know. And you will never know either, so just stop this. And that's the only thing that we know, basically. So that's not the only story. There are a lot of stories like that. I guess disclosing those stories and opening that chapter in the history of Central Asian Koreans, I think this is something that that is a fascinating area of research and storytelling.
I want to shift a little bit to the other side of the Korean Peninsula as well. So you mentioned that there's still some like cultural centers and things like that in Central Asia, but I'm curious about what South Korea is doing, if anything, to reach out to this diaspora in Central Asia.
Yes, definitely. This interest does exist, and those ties do exist, and the effort is there. Basically, as early as Uzbekistan became an independent country in 1991 and afterwards, South Korea has recognized it as an independent country, and we are partners, Uzbekistan and South Korea are partners in trade and economic development. Also, South Korea has been helping the Uzbek economy and our country to reestablish itself, slowly moving towards being an independent market economy and a democratic country, which we are still in the process of. The South Korean government has supported us always in that, and so the ties are there. I think in general, between Northeast Asia and Central Asia now, there is a growing economic cooperation and political cooperation and social cooperation and partnership, which is quite exciting. And personally, I hope it will bring more development to our region and to our country. And we do need it. As for the Korean community in Uzbekistan, South Korea has been supporting culturally and even economically the Uzbek Koreans from the very beginning, basically. And a big role in the establishment of those cultural centers and language centers, most importantly, also was played by South Korea, South Korean government, and cultural institutions and individuals. Of course, the major effort and most important effort was also laid by the local Koreans who wanted in the first place to reestablish themselves as Koreans, as a Korean community, very strong, ethnically and culturally tied and proud Korean community in Uzbekistan. Those centers, they actually started existing in the 1980s after the glasnost and perestroika. And I was mentioning it already earlier that after Gorbachev's perestroika and glasnost, when the Koreans were able to finally talk about the deportation and kind of reestablish themselves as fully fledged Korean communities, that process started in the early 1980s. And independent Uzbekistan, they, of course, wanted even more to reestablish themselves as Koreans. And South Korea supported them, basically helping to establish those cultural centers and language schools, providing funds, providing language teachers, also Korean individuals, South Korean individuals who wanted to go and teach South Korean language. Seoul dialect, the classical Korean language in Uzbekistan. This is actually a very interesting and fascinating topic because the Koreans who came to Central Asia, Soviet Koreans from the Far East, they mostly spoke Hamgyong dialect, which is different from the classical Korean Seoul dialect. So it's interesting because Korean people started learning a different little bit, slightly different, let's say, so Korean language after the independence. And the first generation of Koreans, like the grannies, grandmothers and grandfathers who arrived as the original deportees, they spoke different Korean, Hamgyong dialect. My grandfather, he spoke Korean, for instance, with his siblings and his family. And I myself started learning Seoul dialect in the early 2000. I think I was still living in my home country back then in Tashkent. So I wanted to start learning Korean precisely because of my family heritage. I went to a school which was sponsored and opened by a South Korean teacher and professor. And I learned different Korean. So I remember when I was coming back home and my grandfather was still alive and I was very proudly trying to talk to him in Korean. He was not understanding anything. And he was saying, like, leave me alone. I don't understand it. And it was very, very funny now also to remember it. Yeah, so there is definitely, there are ties and a lot of actually young people, also young Koreans especially, and even older Koreans. I mean, people try to go to South Korea for different reasons, for travel, for leisure. Some want to work or stay in South Korea and go on work visas and do different kinds of work. Younger people, especially those who learn the language and who are more related to South Korean culture, they try to study and work in South Korea. So that there are ties, and it's not easy, of course, because clearly those Koreans who live in Central Asia and former Soviet Union, Korea Sarama, Korea In, they are, I mean, slightly different. It's a different Korean community, and I even heard as South Korean people were explaining themselves that they are like distant relatives, let's say so. Because all of these people at the end are Koreans, but some Korean relatives maybe are more distant than the other. So this is interesting relationship on all levels, and I hope it will continue to foster itself.
So I really like that as a kind of ending note. It sounds like it's a very nice sentiment. But I do want to ask if there's anything else in closing that you might want people to know that we haven't been able to talk about here yet.
Well, I think we have had a quite a fruitful discussion and a long and very interesting discussion. And I thank you very much for your interest and for the KEI, Korea Economic Institute's interest to my story and my project. I don't know if there is something we didn't talk about. I only hope that there will be more interest to this topic in particular and to this area of research and basically to the documentary coverage and storytelling related to the issues of our Koreans, Uzbek Koreans, Central Asian Koreans. I would love to keep exploring it as a researcher, as a Korean specialist myself and a documentary filmmaker, a writer and journalist by training. One thing I would really love to turn my project into because this is a multimedia long read, and I planned it as a long read available online, which you can read and watch the interviews and see photography. I guess I would really love to keep exploring this area, these issues, and maybe turning this project, or let's say so, keep developing this project, because it exists already in its current form. But I would really love to keep exploring it and maybe produce a documentary on the related stories. This is something I would love to keep working on, and I'm currently looking for the ways of cooperation and support to actually turn this into a fully-fledged documentary.
We'll certainly be looking out for it and hoping to see more details, more interesting stories from you. So as we have been talking about, the project is Lost and Found in Uzbekistan, and you can look it up online and see all the videos, all the photos. And so I really encourage our listeners to take a look and see the whole thing. It's very fascinating. So Victoria, thank you so much for being here and for sharing all your experiences and your stories.
Thank you, Jenna, very much. I appreciate your interest and the opportunity to talk about this project and my stories, my Korean stories. Thank you.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. As always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts, and we'll see you here again next week.